Welcome to Preaching Podcasts. For those who proclaim publicly, this is a weekly podcast from the Stevenson School of Ministry, where we take a look at the lectionary from different and distinctive perspectives to help prepare church leaders, teachers, preachers, proclaimers for Sunday worship. I'm your host, Deirdre Good, and here with me is Althea Spencer-Miller and Josh Davis. Hello, you two.
Hey, Deirdre. Hey, Josh. Good to be back.
Hi.
Good to be with you all. Great. Today, we are looking at the readings for Proper 16, I think.
Yes, it is.
Yes, that's it. Great. The Sunday closest to August 24th. Sorry. You know, Pentecost goes on so long, I wanted to make sure I was on the right Pentecost reading. And they're all so close to each other. You know, John 5, John 6, creep, and so on. Anyway, so we're looking at readings from the lessons assigned for the Sunday closest to August 24th. And I'm looking at, in particular, 1 Kings 8. It's absolutely true that Joshua 24 is in track 2, and there's a lot to be said for Joshua 24. But let me, if I can choose just the reading from 1 Kings 8, it's just such a fantastic passage. That doesn't mean to say that I've identified themes from that passage governing our discussion, because, you know, I found that we can generate a discussion about all sorts of things, including themes. But if we could just say that a possible theme on this 1 Kings 8 passage is building, not just any old building, not just a garage, but a building, I'm hoping to assemble a garage at some point in my future, a building that is to house, that is to intimate, that is to make possible, make real the presence of the God of Israel in Jerusalem. And so this 1 Kings 8 passage describes that at some length. And we've only got excerpts from 1 Kings 8 in this series of readings. And it's really a shame. Althea would be the kind of person to remind us that we need to look at the whole passage. But if I must choose a section in accordance with the lectionary choice, I would choose the second paragraph, which is basically verses 22 onwards, when Solomon stands before the altar. In this new building, this new temple in Jerusalem that has been promised to him, not his father, to build, when he stands before the altar of God in the presence of all the assembly, spreads out his hands to heaven, and then he utters a prayer, and the language of the prayer is a description of the God of Israel. There is no God like you. This is apophatic language with which Episcopalians and others are so familiar. You are incomparable would be a Latinate way of saying it, but we don't have Latin influence here in the Hebrew. Keeping covenant and steadfast love for your servants, and so on and so on. And reminding God of promises that God has made, which is always a good thing to do. But look at the next paragraph, which is verse 27. But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Even heaven and the highest heaven cannot contain you, much less this house that I have built. So even within the prayer of Solomon, acknowledging the presence of God in and amidst the people, God's people, not just in the temple, but in the middle of the people, and acknowledging the way in which the ark, which had been wandering with the Israelites in the wilderness for hundreds of years, is now brought out of Egypt and now is relocated in the temple. Even taking those things into account, we have the reminder that God does not dwell in a covenant made with human hands. And I don't know, but I think that it behooves us now and again, I say this as somebody who is pretty regularly in a church building, it behooves us to remember that God doesn't dwell simply in buildings that humans have constructed for God, and that we have to hold these two things in tension. The tension in the history of our traditions, the Israelite tradition, but also 2,000 years of Christian tradition, that is to say, yes, there are buildings that are consecrated and designated as places where we go on specific occasions to worship God, but that doesn't mean that God is exclusively in those particular places. And this text is one that makes it absolutely clear. So we have to hold these two things together. We hold this tension. Anglicans are supposed to be quite good at holding tensions together. So that would be something for our discussion if we want. On the question of buildings, Psalm 84, moving along through our readings, I may have talked about this before, but Psalm 84 is a psalm I absolutely love. Some years ago before the pandemic, we went to Istanbul and we got to see the inside of Hagia Irene, Holy Wisdom, which is an abandoned Byzantine church from the time of the building of Hagia Sophia, Holy Wisdom, which is, of course, if the pandemic were not there, would be full of tourists from across the world seeing it. But it's a Hagia Irene had been abandoned. And we went to see, we got in to see this because the door was open on our last visit to Istanbul. And into this derelict building we came, there were sounds of pigeons, tons of cobwebs, lots and lots of dust. We could make out the structure of the building. We could see the niches at the back around the altar where perhaps other priests were there in days when there were a lot of Byzantine priests and deacons and subdeacons and acolytes and choirs and heaven knows what. And above, we could see the apse, and around the apse was a Greek inscription that turned out to be from Psalm 84. How dear to me is your dwelling, O Lord of hosts. My soul has a desire and longing for the courts of the Lord. But it was verse 2 that to us was jumped to our minds because it was particularly poignant. The sparrow has found her an house and the swallow a nest where she may lay her young. By the side of your altars, O Lord of hosts, my King and my God. But the point being for us that we discovered that even an abandoned building has pigeons in it. This could be an analogy to the sparrows. So the humans may have abandoned the building. You know, subsequent emperors may have parked their horses there. It was a horse stable for many years and so on. But the presence of a sparrow, the presence of God's creation doesn't mean that this is an abandoned building when it comes to recognizing the presence of... There's something about centuries of prayer that inscribe themselves, those prayers, into the walls of buildings. I mean, lots of people have said this before me, but that would just be a tiny little thing that I might note as we go through this.
It's funny that you mentioned Hagia Sophia, because I was thinking about that with this reading, because...
Seriously?
Because Justinian said once it was completed that he said, Solomon, I have outdone you, or something.
Yes.
Like that.
He did. He is alleged to have said that. And that is absolutely true. Yeah. And of course, there wasn't Solomon to say no.
Right. And given our conversations about these texts, that's not necessarily a good thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So. Exactly. But you're absolutely right. Yeah. And of course, we can't see the contours of Solomon's temple because Solomon's temple was destroyed and then rebuilt. Right. And then rebuilt. And then that temple, the second temple, that was destroyed in 70 in the war against Rome and so on. So that only shards of that remain, the great wall that is still available for people to pray at and visit in Jerusalem. But we do have Hagia Sophia. I don't think Hagia Sophia was modeled on the temple, but it was meant to be a replacement for the Jerusalem temple. Yeah, and to reconstitute another Jerusalem, as it were, you know, in the example of Constantinople. So I'm glad you said that, Josh. Have you been looking at Hagia Sophia?
No, I was just thinking about it, and really, cause in this reading about this particular text, it just popped into my mind.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's see. The Ephesians passage isn't really to do with buildings, but the imagery of the Ephesians passage, be strong in the Lord and put on the whole armor of God, is a well-known feature of metaphor, a metaphorical way of describing how how early Jesus believers, like those to whom the letter of the Ephesians was written, might conduct themselves in the light of external hostilities of the empire and so on. Our struggle, the words continue, our struggle is not against enemies of flesh and blood, or blood and flesh, as this translation has it, but against the rulers, authorities, cosmic powers of the present darkness, spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. Take up the whole armor of God. And then we get the whole description of the armor of God. But the other thing I want to highlight in this section from Ephesians, and of course you have your own ideas, is the penultimate sentence in the lectionary choice. This person who may or may not be Paul, who is writing the letter to the Ephesians, is asking for prayers. Pray also for me so that when I speak, a message may be given to me to make known with boldness. This is this parousia, this goal of education in the ancient world, to speak articulately with boldness in public places. And what is it that this person is articulating, this Paul in inverted commas? The mystery of the gospel, the mystery of the gospel. So there's something elusive about the character of what is proclaimed in the phrase. And the next thing also catches my eye, the description of the person delivering the mystery of the gospel, for which I am an ambassador in chains. That's such a great image. You know, there's no notion of having a passport and passing unhindered throughout the realms of the Roman Empire. There's the implication that there is this notion of representation of someone, but also inhibition, that is to say, being in chains. And so the prayer to declare it boldly is you know, it's not so clear that unhindered proclamation characterizes the person who is identified as requesting prayers in this section of Ephesians. I have not talked much about the gospel. That's because we've said lots about the gospel in other places. We can talk about it as our discussion progresses. What should we talk about in particular?
I'm always keen to talk about this bit from Ephesians about cosmic powers and spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places. I think these are always really interesting parts of it, but I don't necessarily think that that's the thematic fulcrum of these readings. So if it comes up, I'm happy to talk about it, but I think there might be some other things to focus on here.
What grabbed me as you're speaking, Deirdre, was the focus on the building. And what the building meant, and while it was a fixed place, it was also an attraction that was larger, certainly in Kings, had to reach beyond the boundaries of the borders of Israel.
Yeah, and one of the wonders of the ancient world, right?
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, it's not the case that in 1 Kings 8 you see much of that, but you actually see in the preceding chapter, most of chapter 7 is given over to the dimensions and specifics of building the temple. So, for example, in 1 Kings 7:2, he built the house of the forest of Lebanon, 100 cubits. In other words, he's bringing in the treasures of the land to manifest the building of the temple, the house of the forest. So he uses cedars of Lebanon. This is, of course, a well-known phrase from the Hebrew Bible. In verse 6, he made the hall of pillars 50 cubits long and 30 cubits wide. Verse 7, he made the hall of the throne where he was to pronounce judgment, the hall of justice. And so all of these were made with costly stones, verse 9. He invited other people, verse 13. He invited and received Hiram from Tyre, who had been an artisan in bronze, full of skill, intelligence, knowledge. He came to King Solomon and did all his work. Do you see? I mean, the whole description of the contours, dimensions, construction, resources, architects deployed, peoples, down to, you know, the smallest elements of the vessels which is in 746. Solomon made all the vessels that were in the house of the Lord, the golden altar, the golden table, the lampstands of pure gold, five on the south side, five on the north, the cups, snuffers, basins, dishes for incense, fire pans of pure gold, sockets for the doors of the innermost part of the house, the most holy place, and so on and so on. I mean, so Althea, I mean, this is all extraordinarily described in detail in the preceding chapter.
Yeah.
Pretty magnificent.
Very much so. And like you said, one of the wonders of the ancient world in its time. It's not a thematic connection, but not an evident thematic connection. But I think about the grandeur of it and what it was meant to represent. Because I would be surprised if it only represented the expansiveness, the expansive idea of God that Solomon speaks to in his prayer. I think about the way in which it's a status symbol for Israel to the peoples around, and then it's all in this. It's all in the in one day's lectionary reading, and different folk might not read all of these passages. Very unlikely that they all will be read, but what's common to both tracts are Ephesians and John. And it's like you move from this grandeur, you move from this power, and then the folk in Ephesians seem worried. There's a reason to be exhorted to stand in the strength of God's power and to put on the whole armor of God. So I'm looking at the contrast between the two groups.
That's a really good point. The times have changed. Times have changed. And you know, the individual person who puts on the whole armor of God is like one person against the world. So it's the world that is the hostile place.
Right.
Yeah. And Althea, the war that is envisaged in this passage in Ephesians 6 is against not just an army. Not just a well-endowed and weaponed and, horrible and fierce army, but also principalities and powers. That is to say, things you can't really see. Things that rule the universe over which you have very, very little control. Forces of sin, separation from the Holy One, cosmic powers of darkness, spiritual powers of evil. I mean, these things... Do we think that armor is going to help in those circumstances? So,
right. Well, and I mean, I think this is partly what was on my mind when I was thinking, when I mentioned that earlier, is that, so like it would be, it's like the way in which these forces that we experience in history are manifestations of this deeper hidden mysterious conflict that's happening kind of behind the veil of history or something like this, or so like the Roman Empire is a manifestation of forces, cosmic forces of evil or something, almost in a sacramental way. I don't know that Ephesians is thinking about it that way, but that's the way in the sense of thinking about the Roman Empire that way, but maybe but because there's a lot of use of that kind of language going on here, and it's like it's martial imagery, put on this armor and this kind of thing. But one connection there would be like, so the temple would be a manifestation of that, this sort of heavenly power. Right. And, or that would be the idea. And then the one thing that we might be able to circle back to is then, the fact that Jesus says, this is going to fall, right. Cleanses this temple, or however we think about it. I mean, clearly that action in the temple is presented by the Gospels as facilitating, or what happens during Holy Week, his crucifixion. So I don't know. There's a lot going on there. I think.
There's a lot going on. I mean, I would say, Josh, on the points about Jesus that you were making so helpfully, I would say that on the one hand, Jesus' whole life is oriented in relation to the temple in Jerusalem. Yeah. And we have to hold that in tension with passages like the dialogue with the woman at the Samaritan woman in John 4, where they're having a dialogue, and at some point later in the dialogue, when they're moving towards, you know, deeper and deeper insight, Jesus says, well, yes, but you're talking about worship in Samaria, and you say that there's worship in Jerusalem, but I'm going to tell you that in the future there is not going to be worship in a particular place.
Yeah.
You're going to worship God in spirit and in truth. You know, so we've got to hold these two. Althea will have her own useful contribution, an insightful contribution to this discussion, but to hold these two things in tension, because during the life of Jesus, the temple in Jerusalem stood, and when the Gospels are written, the temple in Jerusalem does not stand.
Right.
During Paul's letters, the temple stands. So we have to hold that historical reality alongside the way in which the New Testament describes which temple is operative at what time.
And this is one of those places where we could be critical. We could think critically about the decisions made by the lectionary, because, right, it's interesting that they pair this with the, you know, eat my flesh and drink my blood passage, and not I will destroy this temple and it will be rebuilt in 3 days, which would be really interesting pairing there, but it would suggest at least typologically something very different, I think.
Josh, that's a really good point. I think we should send a little note to the people who work on the lectionary.
Well, what are you? I mean, I apologize, because I think Althea was wanting to say something, but I mean, it is a strange decision, right? I mean, since that's such a major part of the gospel presentation of Jesus's ministry, it's very strange to not. I don't know. How are you supposed to handle that, I guess? Because everybody wants to see Solomon's building of this temple as this grand, magnificent event, but then you have this right in the middle of the presentation of Jesus' ministry in the gospel as, you know, serious conflict with this.
Yeah, I would say, I know Althea, I'm going to stop in 2 seconds, but I would just say, Josh, that say in Mark 13, when Jesus is sitting with the disciples, according to Mark, and they're looking at the enormous stones of the Jerusalem temple, and what big stones these are, the disciples are saying, as a backdrop to the whole of Mark 13, which is giving Jesus a chance to say, actually, all these stones will be destroyed. Not because of God's plan, but rather because the Romans are going to march into Jerusalem, and then they will make manifest the destruction of something so extraordinary that their power sort of seems to be a demonstration of the powers that exist on earth. And how will that be incorporated into the this life and death of Jesus of Nazareth is what is being worked out in places like John's gospel, for whom the Jerusalem temple is not so much a present reality, right? And so we can speak of the temple as my body in the language of the Jesus of John's gospel, which you right. wouldn't find that in Mark. So you see what I'm trying to say? I'm trying to sort of plot out in tiny ways the time scheme.
And isn't just simply a correlate, like to say, like the way that you might tend to read that, which is to say, like his body is a temple within which you worship or something like that, which I think it does mean that. But it's also like Rome destroyed his body.
Yeah.
Just as they destroyed this. And then in the context of these cosmic spiritual powers, then you've got this other dimension here. So I will shut up now.
You're absolutely right. A crucifixion is a Roman death. Yes, you're absolutely right. Althea, I think we're waiting for you to be a Dea ex machina. Dea, did you?
I'm here.
That's your cue. That's your cue.
I'm in my own murkiness.
we want whatever you've got.
No, my train is connecting to the stations that you're at, but. It is. I'm pondering the wisdom of the folk who composed and compiled the lectionary readings to ponder what kind of word world have they put us in. Mm-hmm. You know, I, as you were all speaking, remembering, sometimes we talk about Odysseus, the Iliad and the Odyssey. And I think especially of the Iliad at this point, a worldview where the connections between the cosmos, the gods, and the wars of the world are so close that the gods have a kind of elocutionary effect upon physical material reality and what happens in history. And it, you know, it's easy to put it off as ancient superstition, but it makes me wonder what kind of worldview have we entered into? Because certainly as you spoke, you know, the proximities, the temple and the spirituality of God, the material representation of that spirituality with this compelling future in it, and then the sacramental aspect of it that Josh was naming. But then I noticed too in Ephesians, yeah, the you start out with this, put on the whole armor of God, and rightly we ask the question, can armor actually stand up against these cosmic powers of present darkness? But what's pitched against it is the belt of truth, the breastplate of righteousness. The armor seems to get even more feeble as you go along, the gospel of peace, the shield of faith, you know. And but there's a confidence that these can quench the flaming arrows of the evil one. Then I think about the Jesus's words of eat my flesh and drink my blood, and that turns off some people. They turn back and no longer want to be with him. Right. Do they think he's crazy, or are they making certain material connections between what he's saying, not so much the actual eating of flesh, but how do they understand that as transposing into their reality? So those are the ponderings. I did say my own murkiness. Those are the ponderings I think about as I ponder what kind of language world has the compilers of the lectionary placed us in as we think about these things.
Mm-hmm. That's a really good question. It's a really good question.
Yeah, and it may not have an answer, but I feel like I'm on the edge of something, but I haven't quite fallen over yet. Just to see what's on the other side of the edge.
I suppose what I was pointing to is that I think there's some sort of disjunction between the world of the passage in 1 Kings and the Ephesians passage, or even the passage from John's Gospel. There's something. Those passages make sense in a way that requires some sort of juxtaposition to the 1 Kings passage that's not exactly clear for me in the lectionary, the way the lectionary sets it up, I guess. Meaning I don't know that we're supposed to be, I guess what I mean is the Ephesians and John passage seem to be critical of this in some way that's not, that I think the lectionary passage encourages us to celebrate, I guess. But I might be overworking that distinction.
Well, what I think is that the passages, the juxtapositioning of the passages actually can push us in disparate directions and on different trajectories. Because I can see what you're saying about the contradiction, and that Ephesians and John might actually critique the temple. On the other hand, I think I'm seeing the temple is not just a temple. I'm just impressed. Deirdre, you pointed out Solomon's prayer. And as magnificent as a temple is, it cannot contain God. Even the heavens and the highest heavens cannot contain God. So I think I'm contemplating how the narratives place us into this sphere where the spirituality of our materialness and our materiality are actually meeting. But then in terms of what Josh was talking about, the critique, the implicit critique in Ephesians and John, it's almost as if what was wished for by Solomon has actually come crashing down on the Jews of the first century in a way that is just not comfortable and possibly oppressive. The encounter of different peoples has not worked out in the way they thought it might because of the presence of the Roman Empire. And I'm not sure that I'm altogether exactly where Josh was, because I'm grappling with these other things. So if there's a critique there, the experience in the first century is problematizing the vision of Solomon's time. I've forgotten what millennium that would have been in. But in it all, what is the role of values? What is the role of a sense of cosmic arrangements in which we're caught up? Mm-hmm. You know what I'm thinking about, what I have in mind too? I've been dancing a little bit with Wendy Doniger and Bruce Lincoln in recent days, where this is not exactly the language of mythology. I suppose I'm transposing mythology into spirituality here. But where they understand the codedness of a certain kind of mythic stroke spiritual language, that it is not disconnected from the hard realities of history in terms of politics, culture, and so on. So I'm standing in this place where the juxtaposition is not only of texts, but a juxtapositioning of our sense of spirituality as articulated perhaps in Ephesians and in Solomon's Prayer, and how that impacts the real world, that we the material, physical, concrete world that we live in, where our political relationships and social relationships are articulated. Mm-hmm. But you know, I really hate it when the questions get so esoteric or difficult.
I was just going to bring in that last paragraph of 1 Kings 8 that the lectionary has chosen, which we haven't talked about yet, and wondering if what you said, Althea, might be connected to it, because instead of simply celebrating the construction and completion of the building and the promise of God in its midst and the awareness, the nod to the fact that God cannot be confined to human buildings, right at the last paragraph, we've got this mention of a foreigner, and it's connected to the language of the preceding paragraph, which is the prayer that God would pay attention to this house. But the foreigner in the last paragraph, who is not of Israel, comes from a distant land because of your name. There's provision here for a non-ethnocentric reality, a non-specific religious reality. Yeah. Because they will hear of your great name, your mighty hand, outstretched arm. When a foreigner comes and prays toward this house, not even in, but toward this house. So where's the foreigner? Somewhere else. I could be reading this wrong. I'm not a scholar of the Hebrew Bible, but it looks to me like there's a provision for somebody in a foreign place oriented toward this house who isn't of the same religion and the same commitment structure, that even this passage is trying to make provision for that, but not doing it in a hegemonic way, not doing it in a triumphalist way, but simply an acknowledgement that there is some orientation possibility of other people in the rest of the world towards this reality.
Yeah, I think that I'm glad you pointed that out, because that has been, it's been playing in my mind, but I haven't brought it forward, because that is the point at which that verse points to different types of relationships, but that Israel has with other peoples, and the temple becomes a central point in it, a focal point, a point that is the magnet, in a sense, whether it's just of people's attention, awareness, as you were just describing it, or whether people come, as Isaiah foresees it, brings their wares, and it becomes this grand economic center, Jerusalem. But it's not really a but. The temple then becomes such a flashpoint throughout later history. Isn't this a place where Ptolemy tries to set up
image? The emperor, exactly.
And I was also just prancing a little bit with Josephus yesterday, and seeing where the temple, before it's destroyed under Pilate, becomes another flashpoint where Jewish calamities happen. And I think about the temple, and it's extending what we've been thinking about a bit. The temple is connections to calamities, and the sense in Ephesians, which is much later, post perhaps the destruction of the temple, but this sense that the cosmic powers, the spiritual forces of evil in the heavenly places, cause the human to live with a sense of vulnerability, not just, as you were saying, to the emperor, to the armies, and so on, but to what drives them, which is now manifest as evil, and perhaps the other side of the Solomonic aspirations. But there's this sense of the spiritual meeting, or the cosmic meeting the world, and a how humans live in it.
And I just like it. I mean, maybe next year through the lectionary, I'll be approaching this in a different angle, but I'm liking thinking through this in a way that I like thinking about this as a juxtaposition, and continuing to think about it this way, because I just, that line, as we've gotten into this part of David and Solomon's narrative that I've been returning back to again and again, you know, Samuel saying, you know, if you have a king, this is how it's going to turn out. And then see, there's a sense in which, like, prophetically, there's a fulfillment of that even in Jesus's ministry here, right?
Yep.
So, and especially if you think about the fact that Solomon becomes kind of a repetition of Pharaoh. And there's this, you know, the building of this temple is like part of that enslavement of his people, right? There's a way in which the temple itself is meant to be a spiritual manifestation of their God, but is also tied to exploitative enslavement of one's own people. And the fact that Jesus, it comes into conflict with that, especially in the name of or identifying the God's rule with obviously the temple is at the center of his life, but he clearly wants to purify the temple, or maybe there's more to be said about what that action entails really. But nevertheless, when he says, when he's asked about who he is or what he's doing, he doesn't say, I'm purifying the temple. He points to these eschatological messianic signs. And there's a sense in which the people that are running the temple or in relationship to it are part of that continue that line of exploitation with regard to those people. And there's just something to be, it definitely is dialectical. I mean, right in the middle of the temple, you've got this ark with an empty throne. It's almost as if it testifies against it in some ways. But I mean, But at the same time, just as you're pointing out, the foreigner then will learn of who this god is. But is this god, I don't know. I guess I want to say, is this god the one whose purposes are always seen in demolishing these same expressions of hubris and exploitation? And I know that that's a complicated thing to say in relationship to the history of Israel, but it's embedded in the scriptures, right? This dialectical movement. It's part of reading them. So anyway.
Yep.
I hope you continue thinking about it, because I think you're pulling us closer to the complexity of the relationships, the relationship between these passages. There are oppositional strokes in them. There's a veneer, perhaps, but there are contradictions within, and they are contradictions that can exist because of tensions. I mean, it's masterful what you just said about the temple and its glory and Solomon's prayer, but its connection to oppression. And then the conclusion, because the God it glorifies is a God who in the prophets then opposes a kind of oppression that construction of the temple required, you know. And it's that tension, that tension between different human interests and vested interests in the structures, the politics, the institutions that seem to have an undertone and perhaps an undertow in the passage that we're looking at.
I mean, you could say that the existence of first century synagogues in the context of the and before the destruction of the Jerusalem temple is itself an example of the tension that you're talking about. Because even if we get the parents of John the Baptist going to Jerusalem to perform sacrifices in Jerusalem, as the law requires, we know that in the first century, there are synagogues outside Jerusalem, which make it possible to do those sacrifices outside of the center of the city where God resides. So, but nobody in the biblical world will talk about, somehow they're seen as harmonious, and yet they're not quite harmonious, because of the whole of the sacrificial system is oriented around Jerusalem. And yet the synagogues exist and they will proliferate. I mean, what, you know, they don't suddenly shrink and because somebody has an insight that this is not a good idea. No, they expand. And in fact, the existence of synagogues and the tense relationship they have, the tensile relationship they have with Jerusalem is just some characteristic of the world of the New Testament.
Yeah. It's almost like you just described a satellite kind of existence, you know, where you do have the temple and all that it commands and all the alliances that are effected in the temple, which may or may not be to the benefit or even congruent with the experience in the diaspora.
Yeah.
Jewish diaspora, but folk find ways of building their synagogues, yeah, and perhaps waiting and tweaking what Jerusalem stands for out in those places. So it's not you're right. It's not quite as harmonious as it might seem.
So I think Josh is having an effect on me. He's making me try to read more specifically between the lines.
Yeah. It's a good reading thing. From the underside.
That's right. And you've certainly taught me about that, Althea. Right. Reading from the underside. All right. Shall we leave it there?
Yes. Thank you.
Anybody else, Althea? Are you good with that?
I'm good with that. I think we're leaving each other just wanting to discern that more. So Josh, keep thinking. Let's all keep thinking about it. Yes,
Josh, we want you to keep doing this. Thank you. And of course, Althea, you resonate with it. But I also want to thank both of you because you both are working people. And I just so much appreciate your contribution to this discussion, you know, an hour out of your busy week at a time when you know, you're sorting out what's going to happen in the fall and so on. So I'm grateful. I know that our three listeners are very grateful as well. That's to keep us humble.
Yeah.
Okay.
This is life-giving. Love being part of it.
Oh, thank you.
Absolutely.
Thank you all. Okay, great. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.